What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series. Hello, it's Pauline Maranon here, conducting this informal discussion as part of our podcast series on the little book, An Introduction to Legal Principles for Young People, called What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series provides an opportunity for us to discuss some of the subjects in the chapters under discussion or review, and also perhaps to stretch a little beyond or behind some of those principles and the applications of law previously, currently, and with a view to how they would be reformed in the future. Chapter 8 dealt with pleading a case, mitigation, crimes against property and the person, protecting one's good name, types of courts, and appealing a court's decision. Out of that chapter, really, pleading the case, the language of the courts, how the case is presented to the courts, how the arguments are made, and we have discussed this before, and the need for focus and concentration on how to present an argument, how to put together submissions in support of an argument, which would involve, of course, anticipating what the other side might say and what the objections to the submissions could be. Mitigation, we discussed as a means of offering amends in a way, giving an excuse, putting oneself at the mercy of a court or some form of tribunal to say that the person who is accused was in dire or other circumstances which may have given rise to them doing something that they shouldn't have done, and providing support for that, perhaps bringing along witnesses to show good character, to give witness to the circumstances so that the judge or the jury or both would take a view of the circumstances in coming to their decision about how the person should be dealt with. Crimes against property and the person, and we looked at the fact of life that crimes against property are almost as serious as crimes against the person and have always been historically in the law. Protecting one's good name, I suppose, was something of a difference, particularly for the group of learners in the course of the discussions in that chapter. And we all have a right to protect our good name. So if someone says something about you that's untrue and defames you, defames your character, that means calling your character into disrepute, saying things about you in the presence of other people that can be heard, which implies that you are any less good than you are, any less of a human being, or in any way goes to call into question your reputation, your lawfulness, and your good character, your honour, your integrity, and all that goes with that. Then if you write something about a person, if you put it in writing, it becomes a libel. Very interesting set of circumstances there, where if somebody writes something that's untrue about you, or defamatory, which would be putting you in a bad light, something that would cause the ordinary person in the street, there we go again, the ordinary, illusory ordinary person in the street, but the average person, to think badly of you and to cast you in a light. Now, that will differ according to what you are in life. If you have a very high station or a very high job and the comments are about you in your professional capacity, clearly that could also affect your earning a living and continuing in that profession. So it would be causing damages on many layers, many levels. If a newspaper publishes that and then it goes to a newsagent or a bookseller, puts it in a book that's been published by a publisher, all along the line, the chain of responsibility stretches. So even the people who sell the book could ultimately be responsible in a libel action. So taking a case against somebody for what you say is a libel against you, it's a very big case, and those cases are tried by a judge and a jury. And so they're costly because they will be strenuously defended. It became very prevalent a few years ago for people to be taking cases against newspapers. And so recent legislation in both the UK and in Ireland brought in new libel laws and new libel acts. And under those, in the Irish legislation, there is a provision of an offer of amends. So there is that provision also in the United Kingdom's legislation to provide a way of resolving the matter. In the piece of legislation in the Irish Act, interestingly enough, it covered that opportunity for making amends so that if the newspaper came forward or the person who had been accused of the libel came forward and made an offer or wanted to resolve, wanted to apologise, take back what they'd said and somehow make amends, then it would be decided by the court how much that would be. And in a particular piece of legislation, it wasn't crystal clear if it was just the judge. The wording was the court would decide on the award of damages. And that led to, in one recent case, to an appeal from the High Court decision, where the High Court found that the legislation meant it would be the jury who would be deciding, which would be traditional. That was always the way. The juries always made the award in libel actions as to what the damages would be. And in this case, then, the people were not satisfied. They went to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal upheld the High Court. They then didn't like that. The Court of Appeal's decision was then appealed to the Supreme Court, if you don't mind great cost and expense. And the Supreme Court came out very heavily upholding the Court of Appeal and by dint of that, the High Court below, and said that, yes, as the Act stood, it did not specify that the judge would sit hearing the case and that it was consistent with the operation of defamation and libel law that the juries were the ones who made the awards. And so it was decided in that case that they should. There have been very interesting cases over time where people have taken actions and the juries have made what could be described as derisory awards, giving sixpence or £10 because of their view that they've taken, perhaps, of the plaintiff, the person taking the action, where they may have considered that the action was frivolous and needn't have been taken in the first place and that people were making a great fuss about very little. Notwithstanding the fact that they did find that there had been libel, they, by demonstrating their feeling that perhaps this was a waste of public money and time, that they shouldn't have taken the case. So they would make a small offer to, yes, vindicate the person in their claim that they had been wronged, but at the same time say, well, look, it wasn't really worth that much and you're not worth that much, nor is your reputation. So that is the appeal process, if you like, that we discussed in that chapter, going from one layer of the court up to the other and appealing to a higher and higher level. When we discuss the famous case of Rosa Park, the woman in Montgomery who took the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 to 1956, in that case we reviewed it the other day and we remembered that it took about a year, just over a year, for that case to come to court, and that the court found that her claim was upheld on the grounds that it was unconstitutional that a black person should not sit equally in a bus with a white person. And the law was significantly changed then. 381 days it took for that to come to court while there was a boycott on the bus service in Montgomery. Interesting that we used in that the constitutionality of an action. And I suppose it's important to point out that that would be the ultimate court of appeal. And what do we mean by that? Well, most countries have a written constitution. What's a constitution? Well, it's a set of basic laws or principles for a country that describes the rights and the duties of citizens. It's a sort of a set of rules that guides how a country, a state, or other political organization works. The Constitution may tell what the branches of the government are, what powers they have, how they work. It may also state the rights of citizens. So you'll often come across that word. Constitutions concern different levels of organisations, from sovereign countries to companies and unincorporated associations. You might hear of a certain kind of organisation or a club that would talk about its constitution. So it's really when the people who are forming that get together and say, we are setting up the XYZ company or association, and these are the kinds of rules and principles that we want to be bound by and that we aspire to. So a treaty, for example, which establishes an international organization, also has its constitution in that it would define how that organization is constituted, set out its parameters, the powers it has, and the levels within which it must operate those powers towards gaining its objective, and it would define the objective. Within states, a constitution defines the principles upon which the state is based, the procedure in which laws are made, and by whom. Some constitutions, especially codified ones, also act as limiters of state power by establishing lines which a state's rulers cannot cross, such as fundamental rights. The Constitution of India, interestingly enough, is the longest written constitution of any country in the world, containing a huge amount. It is 146,385 words. United Kingdom, interestingly enough, doesn't have a written constitution. It has the Bill of Rights, the Great Charter, called the Magna Carta, which translates as the Great Charter, one of the most important documents, as it happens, in history, as it established the principle that everyone is subject to the law, even the king, and guarantees the rights of individuals and the right to justice and the right to a fair trial. So where did that come from? Well, in 1215, yes, we're going back a very far time, 1215, a band of rebellious medieval barons forced King John of England to agree to a long list of concessions, later called the Great Charter, or in Latin, the Magna Carta. We found that centuries later, America's founding fathers took great inspiration from this medieval pact as they tried to force their new nation's founding documents, including the Declaration of Independence, their Constitution, and their Bill of Rights. So it was a very significant document and a touchstone, a basis upon which other countries would build their constitutions. Though many people have often said that it is difficult in the United Kingdom at times, so they don't have a written constitution. And they have really talked about sovereign power being the way that they were constructed. For the 18th century political thinkers in the United States, like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, the Magna Carta was a potent symbol of liberty and the natural rights of man against an oppressive or unjust government. The founding fathers' reverence for the Magna Carta had less to do with the actual text of the document, which is really quite medieval when you think it comes from the 13th century, but rather that it represented an ancient pact safeguarding individual liberty. And that is really the central tenet of most countries who have constitutions. A lot of countries that had been colonized by other powers, when they gained their independence, set up their own constitutions. And if you look up a list of all of the constitutions of the different countries in the world, you can run down that list and notice the countries who were colonies, who, when they got their freedom, then wrote their own constitutions. So I suppose one of the most important things about the Magna Carta was the right to trial by a jury, protection against excessive fines and punishments, safeguarding of individual liberty, and perhaps the most importantly, the forbidding of taxation without representation, and that the king ultimately would be subject to the law. So it brought in that whole idea that there was nobody above the law. So if you look at some of the countries, I'll just mention a few of them, ones that are relevant. November 1949, the Indian Constitution, nearly 150,000 words. 1937, the Irish Constitution, 16,000 words. That was when Ireland had gained its independence. It constructed its own constitution. And then we had 1997, South Africa, February 1997, 43,000 words in the South African Constitution. Can you imagine how significant that was for black people who were not only having the opportunity for self-determination and representation, but were actually having a hand in designing and constructing their own constitution for their own country that had been, of course, colonized. June 1849, Denmark, one of the most powerful Central European countries at various times in history, sitting right there in the middle of European, Northern European countries. 1849, only 6,000 words in the Danish constitution. Then 1814, the Netherlands. That's the early part of the 19th century. December 1978, Spain, 17,000 words. And that was after the way that Spain had been run by a military dictatorship, and eventually then had an overturn of that and designed its own constitution, 1978. It's difficult to take that in, really, to think of a country like Spain having to wait so long. And then again, to look back, Norway was 1814. So when we're talking about constitutions, it's worth looking again to political commentators. And I would ask you to consider or take down a note for some time, if you're ever studying the subject, to look at a very interesting intellectual who was an Italian political scientist specialized in the study of democracy and comparative politics. I don't know about you, but I always used to think when I was growing up and through my studying years at university that it would have been absolutely wonderful to have had someone who would just set down comparisons and do an analysis that I could study and look at, someone who'd put massive research into looking at the progress of democracy and of the development of equal representation in different states. And this man was called Giovanni Sartori. He was a very well-acclaimed and much-lauded political scientist, and that was his specialism, to look at democracy. Now, he had an interesting idea, and he was noting the existence of national constitutions, which he would say can be dangerous facades. There can be a facade for authoritarian sources of power. In other words, take care, always look behind the facade, that sometimes the documents may express respect for human rights or establish an independent judiciary. They may be ignored when the government feels threatened, or never put into practice. So he gave as an extreme example the constitution of the Soviet Union, that on paper supported freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. However, citizens who transgressed unwritten limits were summarily imprisoned at one stage in that country's history. So that example was given just to demonstrate that protections and benefits of a constitution, and its own not only example from that one country, but in many instances, that they are ultimately just provided through its written terms, but through deference by government and society to its principles. So in other words, that really the protections and benefits of a constitution really only exist and are meaningful to the population, not just through written terms, but through deference and respect by government and society to the principles. It's back to what we were talking about, the partnership and the relationship between communities and the police, by offering them the power to police their society, saying, we will give you this power to do this, to look after us and keep us safe. And that's that agreement, that's that handshake, that bond, that trust, but it has to be two ways to be meaningful. Similarly here, in order for the constitution to be of any great value, there has to be that respect by government and society to uphold the principles of the constitution. And if the constitution needs to be reviewed, then parts of it would be subject perhaps to a referendum being put to the people if they thought there were parts of the constitution that needed to be repealed or to have new provisions included in the constitution. So I'm afraid Giovanni Sartori also said that a constitution may change from being real to a facade and back again as democratic and autocratic governments succeed each other. So rather worryingly, it does say at the end of the list of all the countries and their constitutions that there is an average duration of constitutions, a very low average, almost to the extent that I wanted to look further into that, of 19 years. So it is rather worrying, as Sartori says, that we have to keep an eye out to make sure that those constitutions are not just something very fancy in writing. So constitutions are often, but by no means always, protected by a legal body whose job it is to interpret those constitutions, and where that's applicable, declare void executive and legislative acts which infringe the Constitution. That's back to what I was saying at the beginning of this before I digressed. In other words, if it appeared that some act or some step had been taken that was unconstitutional, then there could be a reference of that to the Supreme Court or to the President, depending on the way that the constituent parts of the democracy were formed, that maybe the Supreme Court could be the ultimate arbiter of whether there was a breach of the Constitution. And indeed, maybe the President might have the power to refer a bill going through before that President signed it, if they believed that this was something that looked as if it could be in contravention of the principles of the Constitution, and he or she might then refer the matter to the Supreme Court for review. In some countries, such as Germany, the function is carried out by a dedicated constitutional court, which performs this and only this function. In other countries, such as in Ireland, the ordinary courts may perform the function in addition to their other responsibilities. So, therefore, in the United Kingdom, the concept of declaring an act to be unconstitutional doesn't really exist as such. A constitutional violation is an action or a legislative act that is judged by a constitutional court to be contrary to their constitution. That is when we say it's unconstitutional. So an example of a constitutional violation by the executive could be a public office holder who acts outside the powers granted to that office by a constitution. An example of a constitutional violation by the legislature is an attempt to pass a law that would contradict the constitution. You remember when the young people were asking in the course of the discussions in the book about whether that could happen, that kind of difficulty arising where mistakes would be made or whether laws could be made that didn't actually fulfill the objective of the country's intentions, i.e. their constitution. In this instance, then, if there was an attempt to pass a law that could contradict the constitution without first going through the proper constitutional amendment process, that would be a violation of the constitutional principles. Some countries who don't have codified constitutions haven't got those courts. So traditionally, the United Kingdom has operated under the principle of parliamentary sovereignty, under which laws passed by the United Kingdom Parliament could not be questioned by the courts. However, there was quite a historical moment last year in 2019 when the UK Supreme Court judges ruled unanimously that the Prime Minister Boris Johnson then's decision to prorogue, it's an interesting word, P-R-O-R-O-G-U-R, it's a word which means to dissolve or to step down Parliament, which he had taken steps to do, can be examined by judges. So it was a momentous decision because nothing like that had ever happened before. The Supreme Court ruled that Boris Johnson's Prime Minister Privy Council, their advice to the Queen that Parliament should be prorogued for 5 weeks at the height of the Brexit crisis, was unlawful. So the unanimous judgment, as the country looked on, and indeed the rest of the world, because it was such an interesting case, the unanimous judgment from 11 justices on the UK's highest court followed an emergency three-day hearing that exposed fundamental legal differences over interpreting the country's unwritten constitution. So there you had a moment in history where there wasn't a written constitution, but decisions had to be made as to whether this was in breach of the structures envisaged as being that separation of powers that we have discussed before. So the 24th of December 2019, the decision was read out by Lady Hale, President of the Supreme Court. It was an interesting moment, and it was a significant moment in history, and one which you should bear in mind as being something that has happened relatively close in time to our discussing this little book on the principles of law for young people. And I hope that you're finding the podcasts of some assistance in thinking around the subjects and possibly providing you with an incentive to look into some of the subjects in more depth, not just if you intend studying law, but if you're looking at history, if you're looking at politics, or as we saw earlier, social science and many other subjects where an understanding of the way we administer our countries and where we aim and attempt to bring about a fair and just society. And it's all about justice in the end. Thank you.